Do people worry that AI is going to take their job? Sure, they worry about that. And what I say is, don't worry about AI taking your job. Worry about the person who's using AI who's going to take your job, because that's what's going to happen more likely.
Welcome to Modern Business Operations, where we talk with leaders about how ops is adapting to our modern world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Modern Business Operation. My name is Sagi. I'm the CEO and founder of Tonkin. And today I have the pleasure of hosting Alistair Erskine. Hey, man. Thank you so much for joining me.
How are you doing, Sagi?
Very good. Well, Alistair, you hold a lot of different very, very important roles. I want to go through all of it, but very high level. You're CIO, Chief Information Digital Officer, CIDO at both Emory Healthcare and Emory University. You're also a lecturer at Harvard Medical School, and you're associate physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Already here, so much I want to talk to you about, from a physician to a chief information officer. But before we dig deeper, if you don't mind, in your own words, a little bit about how did you get to this place you're in right now in your career and being able to do all of this stuff together? I'm keen to learn.
Yeah, no, thank you. Well, you know, life happens to you when you're busy making other plans. I don't think I would have necessarily taken that route exactly the way I did. I grew up in Europe. I was born in London, lived in Paris and Barcelona, and immigrated to the States. I went to college in Virginia and medical school in Virginia, and then did my residency for internal medicine and pediatrics in Providence, Rhode Island at Brown, and end up going back. And then as I was practicing medicine, I just noticed all the inefficiencies that all the doctors complain about in terms of using electronic health record. I complained too much about it, and somebody says, well, why don't you fix it? And so at the time, there was a role called a CMIO, Chief Medical Informatics Officer. And it basically was a clinician that was like a double agent, spent half of their time seeing patients and the other half of their time helping configure in these systems. So that just seemed like a perfect fit. And I did that for several years, then did the same thing with the research side of the house. So, you know, medical research has similar kinds of problems. They don't use an electronic health record, but they use similar kinds of tools, electronic notebook and so forth, and help with that. And then because I spoke a few languages and I was being asked to go to different countries to talk about informatics, which was this kind of concept of how do you provide advice as somebody who's using a system to help configure the system and so forth, solution architect in the system. End up in the Middle East and end up in Doha in Qatar and took on a role there of starting a hospital from scratch called Sidra. And it was a fascinating exercise of having essentially an unlimited budget and making an unlimited number of bad mistakes as a result. And then after a few years of that, evidently went back to the States, went to the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, in a wonderful organization called Geisinger that was half a health plan and half of a clinical delivery system. I learned a lot about the sort of health plan side of things, and then did an MBA at MIT for a couple of years, which had me flying from the middle of Pennsylvania to Boston every other week, and eventually took on a role at Mass General Brigham Hospital, where that organization did about $2.4 billion worth of research each year. So learned a lot about how does research, bench research, translational research, manifests itself in the clinical delivery system. And then finally, about a year and a half ago, I end up at Emory, an amazing organization in Atlanta, Georgia, which is close to the CDC and has just been an amazing, innovative organization trying to figure out what to do next in healthcare.
Incredible. All over the world too. So it's not all over the industry, but also all over the world. That's super, super inspiring. Let me double click on a couple of things there, because first of all, just the initial kind of point of that what was it?
CMIO?
CMIO, yeah. So that middleman almost, right? Of both kind of the business needs, which is in this case, it's like what is happening in the point of care and the medical needs of the physicians and then kind of like what technology allowed to do. This is always like I'm super intrigued with those roles all the time, right? And I've had a lot of folks on the show from operation kind of teams that are a lot of times are playing that similar role, like attorney that came, you know, technical representative, if you will. But what is not very common is that you start from there and you end at the CIO level. So let's double click on this for a second. So first of all, what are some things that was glaring to you at that back then when you really kind of came into that role?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, I actually remember very specifically the day that I thought I wanted to go into this. So I'm sitting writing a note for a neurology patient on the wards, a patient that had come out of the ICU. And I look over and the clerk on the desk is carrying the recycle bin close to the printer and has taken reams of paper that had just got printed and putting them into the recycle bin. And I'm writing my note. I'm looking over at her. I'm going like, what are you doing? And she says to me, oh, every 8 hours, this damn thing, I got to fill it full of paper. And then these things print out that nobody looks at. And, you know, I just got to take that stuff and put it, I figure I should recycle it. And I'm thinking, okay, what? So I found out these were reports that were being built years ago that just were printing out. I did the back of the napkin envelope calculation, figuring out how much paper was being wasted and so forth. And I found out it was like $1 million a year of printing and ink and et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, okay, I'm going to go to whoever does this committee to figure out, well, surely they're going to want to just turn this off. So I go up there, proud, brand new, you know, young pup kind of physician, proud of myself. I'm going to go up there. Look, I got this great thing. Look, we're printing this stuff, paper everywhere. Nobody's reading it. We just turn it off and save $1 million. At which point somebody said to me, we can't. Patients will die. And I thought, oh, I'm hooked. That's really interesting. Why would you think that? Like, literally nobody's using it. And I realized that there was a major disconnect between what people thought was happening in the clinical environment and what was actually happening in the clinical environment. As a physician, you know, practice, I knew what was happening because we're using it every day. And so I realized the way systems are being configured with the super clever analysts and project managers, what they're missing was a good sense of exactly what clinical practice was like. What is on somebody's mind? How do they interpret the information on the screen? What's more important to them? What's not so important to them? What's a gizmo? What's something that's really practical to what they're trying to accomplish? And that was the role essentially of the CMIO, which was to bring that workflow expertise. I didn't need to know a lot of clinical things in order to be able to be good CMIO. I just need to know how do physicians, nurses, pharmacists, others practice to help patients and then bring that experience to the people configuring the system and then help them choose and prioritize and decide what was best. And even in some cases, understanding the art of the possible in technology, then I could go back to my colleagues and say, did you know that now you can actually walk into a room, the system can record your voice, and it will actually generate the clinical note for you. And people are like, you know, that's amazing. Let's go ahead and put that up next. So I think that gap of how to configure a system based on actual practical use and the change management required to be able to get my colleagues on board and to get the coalition, the Willem going, and then to kind of be able to talk to the Luddites who didn't want to have anything to do with technology and eventually bring them on board. All that became part of what a CMIO does.
Well, I love it. Well, I had multiple oh my God moments, you know, as you kind of going through it and how visual it is, right? The first oh my God moment is that imagining that paper come out of the printer directly into the bin, you know, kind of like just the depth of the waste. And I think so many people have experienced that. But then the second one is the people will die. Let's unpack that for a second, because I used to say years ago, where a lot of those new technologies came out, I used to say that the biggest barrier for innovation is change, right? And when you think about that in this moment, how do you go around that? So you took the job. What are some of the things that worked for you? Looking at, and again, I like the visualization of it, because the medical institution in general, I think for patients too, and I'm sure for physicians as well, but it feels like the one where they're going to be the most red tape to make change, because again, the implication could lead to not only loss of money, but, you know, loss of things, you know, worth more than money, like life and so on. So the question becomes, how do you navigate that politics? It almost becomes harder problem than the technical or the workflow problem.
No, you're exactly right. In fact, oftentimes the technical aspects are not the hard parts in the change management. And I would say what I was taught is that sometimes you can look at change through three lenses. One lens is a blue lens. It's a technical lens. It's the steel, like logical thinking. The second lens is the red lens. That's the emotional lens. Like when the person said, patients will die, very emotionally engaged. The third lens is the white lens. And that is a cultural lens. And the reason it's white is you just can't really even see it. It's not something you can point to. It's kind of like everything. It's like the fish in the water bowl with water around. It's the things that people put up on the wall. It's the things that people talk about at the water cooler. It's the way that people do things. And so all three of those lenses have to be negotiated in doing a change. Now, probably the most useful thing when you're a change agent is to come with some degree of trust and respect. So if I'm a physician talking to another physician about something that a physician is supposed to adopt, it's going to be easier for me than if even a physician talking to a nurse. The nurse will say, hey, you don't really know what I do. And maybe if I had a nurse talking to a nurse, that would work better. But already, if I can speak the same language as a physician who understands that I appreciate and empathize what it's, that's going to make it a bit easier. But anything that you bring to a system that you want to change, there's going to be this kind of bell curve of early adopters who will just run and always adopt the latest, newest thing. Most people are going to wait and watch. And then those who are going to go kicking and screaming because they just don't want to change. And I think it's almost like a race to the top of a hill. If you can get the early adopters to get more of the wait and watch people as they go up the hill, and those that don't want anything to change, they're racing up the hill. Whoever gets to the top of the hill first wins in the change management. So I also think that you've got to break change down into multiple component parts. If you try to do the workflow change, the people change, the technical change all at once, sometimes that can be overwhelming to a system and it's too much of a shock to the system. And you'll just bounce back out. It's almost like you're trying to come into orbit. If you got the wrong angle, you're just going to either bounce out or not. You want to get just the right angle in. So you come in and get to the point where you've been able to kind of spread out that change across the will in, and in some cases, be clever about how to adopt. Is there a way to be able to spread out the change over time to make it easier for the system to accommodate? Now, there's a few things I do to be able to prepare myself. There's something I do called streaming rounds. So, you know, in medicine, you round on patients. Well, I came up with this idea, which has worked so well, which is every Monday and Friday for 2 hours in the morning, I'll go to a unit, ICU, pharmacy unit, the warehouse, a data center, whatever it may be. And I'll bring my assistant with me, and she has a gimbal and an iPhone, and she streams the experience. And I have my team jump on that. So hundreds of people that are online, and they're watching what's happening at the point of care or in the front line. What it does is it brings all of them closer to the purpose and the mission that we're trying to accomplish. And they can be anywhere in the US or anywhere in the world watching this experience where I'm talking to the leaders of the cardiology department, then going and seeing the cardiology department. And what that does is several things. Number one, it helps me understand really, oh, some technology that we put in, did it actually get adopted? Is it working the way we intended? What's the reality on the ground? Number two, the people who are configuring that, they're watching the reaction positive, in some cases very rewarding, negative. Okay, what changes do we need to make? And it also shows the people that we're coming to that we care enough to come to their place, meet them where they are, to be able to. It's just been like a wonderful management approach that addresses some of the remote workers that you may have, especially post-COVID, that don't always feel like they're part of the purpose and that they belong in the part of the team.
This is what I called. Like, you can't really express enough how important the ability to, you know, they're always like leaving someone's shoes or day in their life, but the ability to come and observe. You know, there's something I also really believe in and been saying a lot in this podcast too, to folks that lead change, folks that own a process in an executive level or an operation level. And I also find it funny how little that sort of like area was researched and maybe kind of like have even academic or methodology attached to it, which is truly that operation people are product people. They just don't know it yet. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of the things you're describing is sort of like the ultimate dream for like a product person that builds solution to go to market with, to be able to literally go once a week to their end users, kind of like really observe, like with a GoPro on their head, just like literally go and see what our people are doing. And in some products you can do that, but not really, because you can't actually observe how people feel about it too when they click the button. Do they click it and get mad, frustrated, or they're like, look at this, all giggly, of like how fun and faster this is. I used to be needing to do it for 10 minutes and now it's like 2 seconds, right? So I love this. And I think this is actually also actionable for people listening in, the ability to actually mimic that behavior. You said twice a week you're doing it, or once a week? That's crazy. That's great.
You know, twice a week. I think in the new role, I may have to go down to once a week. But when you think about it, it's a lot of time, but it's a lot of time saved in working on otherwise unnecessary things by being close to the end user. I'm making sure that I'm not just, it's readjusting my prioritization mechanism. I do something else that I think is very helpful. It's something called trickle feedback. Now, trickle feedback, you take the entire population of people you're trying to work with. So in our case, we have 45,000 people at Emory, and you break them into groups. You divide that number by 365. And every day you send a very simple Net Promoter Score survey, you know, 0 to 10 stars, and an open comment box, and say, does technology help you do your work? Is the question, very simple question. And I was surprised how you only send that survey to 1/365th of your entire population each day, but every day it's a different of those. So once a year, everybody's been hit once.
Yeah.
But so unobtrusive and so small on a given day, that the number of people that actually answer it is like 40%. So 40% of the people will actually give you a score in every walk of life. It's the doc, it's the person in the back end administrative office, it's the clerk, it's the folks that transport the patient. It's everybody using the system. And that open box, 20% of the time, they put something in there. And sometimes it's paragraphs of information, you know, that vent in or whatever it may be. Yeah. And now we have clever tools like GPT to be able to process all those comments and figure out what the key themes are and get the sentiment analysis from the keywords that are being put in there. And that is an incredible, so you can slice and dice that data after a certain period of time where you can tell, okay, the nurses in this hospital all feel this way about something. Therefore, I need to spend more time working on this particular component that's broken because all the nurses are upset about it. Or the anesthesiologists are unhappy in the OR because of this particular issue. So being able to slice and dice data from a trickle feedback where it's hidden most people only once a year is a way to get really, there's nobody interpreting that. You're all talking to the front line at that point. It's that person who's using that tool, who's clicking that button, who goes from 10 minutes to a few seconds, right? You're getting their opinion.
I like the idea here as well. There's a nuance here because you can say, oh, let's do like a survey for the entire company or workforce or user base once a year. That would like also hit everyone once. But the problem is then you only get feedback once a year. So you're living on an outdated feedback for months. Plus, there's a lot of that feedback is going to go to waste. Sure, you can use aggregation and make technologies, but like you won't be able to get some of the nuances if it's so much. Even the 40% be a lot in one day. And just to, what I like about this approach, the first time I'm hearing it, is that also gives you a more up-to-date thing, right? So like in March versus in June, you'll have like the people that answer are already in a different reality if you implemented something in April, right? So it allows you to stay up-to-date. And I think that's a great method. You mentioned GPT. Maybe that's a good segue. You know, you started the CMIO, when was that? How many years ago?
That's 2005.
2012, about almost 20 years ago. Technology has massively progressed. I think also the medical industry openness, obviously medical technology is always front runner on some areas, but then it feels like the back office technology, if you will, was very lagging. First, maybe before we go to the future with AI, but like, how was that arc in that last 20 years, in your opinion? Was it like very steadily getting better, or is it accelerating or decelerating?
So I would say that it was pretty steady. Now, there was a huge infusion of cash in the American healthcare system with something called high tech in 2008 after the market crashed with the housing crisis, where the government felt compelled to pour a lot of money into the economy, you know, to be able to recover. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act basically said, look, we have all these health systems. They're not digitized and not using electronic health records. We're going to make sure that every health system in the U.S. is incented to put in an electronic health record and digitize healthcare. So over the next several years, that in fact happened. And everybody rushed who hadn't already been on an EMR and put in Cerner, Epic, Meditech, all these large systems. Now, what happened is the system got digitized. It wasn't necessarily optimized for clinical workflow, but that was definitely an inflection point in terms of being able to have the data online. And then from that point forward, over time, I think sort of a gradually, incrementally got better. The software got better, became more powerful, more intuitive. And then when GPT came out, it was another inflection point. I think that inflection point probably happened a little bit earlier with imaging analysis. So we use something called PAC systems, which are picture archiving systems where all the CT scans and MRIs are located. And the radiologists have been using AI and deep machine learning to automatically diagnose a CT scan with a stroke, for example. But I think the rest of us who weren't working purely in imaging, who were just working on text, now suddenly had this new tool, GPT, that we could use to do all kinds of things we could have never imagined. And I think probably one of the most useful ones these days in healthcare is ambient listening. And ambient listening means I walk in a doctor's office as a physician. I ask my patient, is it okay to record this? They say yes. I put down my iPhone and have a regular conversation. I'm not distracted looking at the keyboard and the mouse and the screen. I'm paying attention to what the patient's saying. We're having a communication. I do the exam. I call out various different findings. And then I talk to them about the assessment and the plan. And then at the end, I press stop on the recording. And that transcript gets converted using a large language model into the clinical note I would have otherwise written with all the different things that you would typically expect into that note, including the diagnoses, the assessment, the plan, et cetera, et cetera. That's saving me some time in documentation. It saved me a lot of cognitive load and having to remember of the 30 patients I saw today, the third one that needed the MRI, making sure that is captured in the note, that I don't forget that I don't have to remember that. And it's helping capture what actually happened in the exam room instead of what's copy and pasted from somebody's note from before. So that is a technology that really changes the world of the patient. Satisfaction goes up, the provider, they're not staying up until 11 o'clock at night as much, writing notes. Those are the kinds of pivots that we're seeing. We're seeing that now with video. So we're doing AI cameras in the hospital now, where the system is looking at the patient, making sure they don't fall out of bed. And if they do, it's warning us before they fall using a LiDAR sensor. And at the same time, it has a pan zoom camera that can tell, you know, that can bring a nurse, a virtual nurse or a virtual doctor, or even the family to come visit the patient while they're still in bed. So really changing the way the patient experiences the inpatient environment. These are all technologies that, you know, without large language models and the ability to interpret the streaming image that is coming from that LiDAR sensor and on chip is being processed with a 38 teraflop processor that doesn't even require the internet, you know, to be able to tell whether the patient's going to fall out of bed or not. It's just incredible technology. And it has practical use. It's reducing falls by something like 85%, which is patients that fall, sometimes they're okay. Sometimes they really get badly hurt. So you're really saving. This is one of those things where you're really saving people from really bad injury while they're in the hospital, where you obviously don't want them to get injured. which, you know, is having an impact on clinical care.
This episode is brought to you by Tonkin. Tonkin is the operating system for business operations, providing businesses with the building blocks to orchestrate any process with no code or change management required. Contact us at Tonkin.com to learn how you can build complex processes fast.
Well, I think even the falling out of bed is a very kind of like a very cut and dry, obvious ROI, right? It's like, less people are falling down and hurt. I think there's a soft, that is very real example that you mentioned earlier. And even when you listed the things that you saved, like I think the biggest thing you kind of mentioned earlier that you didn't list, which was patients, you know, satisfaction. And I think we're a service, you know, that provide AI and workflow and orchestration and automation. And a lot of people are asking me a lot of times, like, can you give me an example of like why, if an AI takes away this type of tasks, like what will happen to the job? Funny enough, it's on both sides. Some people will be like, why would I want to talk to a person if I can just have something resolved for me? And the other side of people will be like, why would I want to talk to a bot if I'm calling a doctor? What you described, I've experienced already myself, like a doctor, like recording, asking to record and all that stuff, where you get to a point that you can truly just talk to a person, right? And you unlock something that is, that might have been lost in some areas of just our different industries, and especially maybe in the medical industry, where truly you want to go to your like primary care provider, like literally the word care, right? Like health care, like someone that care about what you're about to say. But they're so overloaded with the logistics around it, which are important logistics. If you don't capture the note, how would you be able to act on it and so on and so forth? You don't want to mess it up. But when someone typing, looking at you and on this, like you feel like a lab rat versus when someone is talking to you, right? Like those nuances are far more important when you think about them at scale and when you think about them at the future, right? Like, what is that role going to look like in the future? And what does it mean to go get checked, for example, and preventative care and other things? So I find fascinating and I find very exciting too, that some people would might think that the AI right now with LLMs and stuff is kind of overhyped, because what you see all the time is those examples of how it helps you write a blog or create a funny cat picture or whatever it is. Obviously, like you said, machine learning and other in imaging has been there for a bit, but the fact that same technology is currently already showing incredible innovation and new already tagged it as the next, as second leap. I find it super inspiring and an important message out there, because I don't think the majority of people hearing about AI and LLMs think about it as something that is already changing stuff. Everyone are seeing it as an exciting technology right now. Everyone are thinking about the potential of it. Not enough people understanding the immediate use cases and impact it can do.
So a few things. Number one, do people worry that AI is going to take their job? Sure, they worry about that. And what I say is, don't worry about AI taking your job. Worry about the person who's using AI who's going to take your job, because that's what's going to happen more likely. Second thing is, a lot of technology that we've experienced, even on social media, has not brought people closer together from a human species societal perspective. In fact, there are studies that show that teenage girls get depressed and when they sit on social media and feel more distant. And my own kids, I got three kids, they would sit in the back of the car with their friends and they would all be on their phone talking to each other through their phone, even though they were sitting right next to each other, basically grunting, like without turning to each other to talk to each other. They were basically on their phone. So I think what we're looking for, especially in healthcare, are technologies that improve connectedness and don't actually make us worse off. What I like about the ambient listening technology is it brings the patient and the doctor back together the way they're supposed to be, not actually pulling them apart because something's getting in the way, like a screen and a mouse. The question is, what other technologies do we have that are going to be able to bring people closer together? Because that touch of a patient's hand is very therapeutic and it's important. And to your point about, you want to You want your doctor to care, to truly care about you. And you want them to, you don't want to have a bot break bad news about your loved one or that you've got cancer or some other condition. You need another human who's experiencing the human condition to sit with you in your anxiety and fear and reassure you. And so I still think this always going to be, we're not, you know, until we become totally synthetic beings that get uploaded to some bot that runs around, we're going to still want to socialize. We're still going to want to, that's what human beings are. They're social creatures. And I think AI can do a wonderful thing when it comes to automation, when it comes to removing some of the administrative burden. But when it comes to creativity, now that is uniquely human. And when it comes to coming together in societal groups, that is something that defines us. So I think there's always a role for AI, but I don't think we're at a position where it's replacing yet what we do as clinicians. I think it can diagnose things better than certain radiologists. It can diagnose things better in terms of certain pathologists. There's some bit pieces. You can have robots now perform surgery using Da Vinci machines in some other part of the world. They're amazing things, but those are tiny slices of the care process that don't make up the entire care process.
You know, if I combine this entire conversation, I do think this is a role that, if anything, should be accelerated, that CMIO example of a role. Again, in your industry, but in other industries as well. That idea, I personally like to call folks like yourself makers. You're not coming from like engineering the problem. You're not coming from like the mathematical part of the problem, but you're also not coming from it as a sole user of the realm. But it's really about making something with the tools and technologies and capabilities that are available to a new place that doesn't have it, and really kind of like make something that wasn't there. But going back to my point, this role is going to be even more important in the future, because the difference between how we actually making things better or not is leaning in to what is those technologies can do for you. Just kind of repeating what you said, but really the nuance I love about this is it's not about whether it's going to replace certain things or not. The question is, should those things actually still be the way they are or not? And I know for a fact that if I just need to order personally, but like as a person want to order like their prescriptive drugs that you just get every week, why would they need to call someone? Like, it's crazy. Like, let them have it to one click. That just maybe even may automatically suggest it, send them a notification, say, hey, I already know your, because I kept track of what you order. For my notes, the app would say, you're low. You should order more. Like, those are the things you want as seamless as possible. But if you're worried, if you're scared, you're confused, you want to talk to someone. You don't want to answer a survey. You don't want to answer a question with 1,000 questions and send pictures of things you might don't want to. Like, you don't want to do that. You just want to talk to someone. And so leaning in to me means that not coming from a fear, but actually coming from, like you just said, when you were green, sitting there watching the printer print away into the garbage bin, where you, is that, does that make sense? With what I know right now, does that make sense? And I love that. And I think that's very, very, very simple, practical things for people to think, instead of fantasizing of what will be, just lean in what is already here and ask, like, is that actually how we would want it if we'll do it again? And I would spend an hour with you just talking about the new hospital you try to build from scratch, but maybe we can keep that to another.
I'll give you a teaser. We're opening the first hospital on the planet that only uses Apple products.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So iMacs, iPads, Apple Watches, iPhones, the whole thing. And that's just because, why do we always use Windows-based products in every single hospital you ever see everywhere around the planet? You know, that makes no sense. Like, if the Apple product is lasts twice as long, it's more cyber resilient. Most people know how to use it without any instruction. It has software that comes with it, like the operating system. You don't have to buy separately. If you look at the cost, it's actually, you can save $300 per device per year based on the number of times people call the support desk and the software that's already on it. It's an interesting thing. Again, your point about the whole point about change, the industry hasn't changed when it comes to what device to put in a hospital. So at Emory, we're like, you know what? We'll be the first so that other people can follow. But there's no reason why we shouldn't have a choice when it comes to something like that. So just a really interesting overtone on the conversation around change at different levels, change between the way the clerk works when she's recycling paper off her printer, change in the way the doctors and nurses can handle changes in workflow, change in the way the patient experiences care with AI and with care. And then change in the way that CIOs decide to build hospitals with Apple products or Windows-based products.
Hey, there's opportunity everywhere. That's what I got out of that last note. It's literally like wherever, you just need to look for it. And you just need to look and you say, wait, why? Why is it like this? And there's going to be opportunity there. But man, that sounds cool. And a whole hospital that did Apple products. But yeah, I get your point completely. It's everywhere. Let me ask you a question I like to ask, you know, everyone, especially as we talked about all those great learnings and great tips that you're already doing today, from how you do the survey, your end users, to like how look for change. But let's talk personally speaking. You know, usually there's like, can you recall one or two kind of core principles or advice that you got early in career that kind of drives you? So I always ask, any such kind of like advice you got early on that you think worth paying forward?
So I think I can summarize it in terms of just feedback. So the principle is really one where you learn to empathize and sympathize with whoever you're trying to change in a technology world, just by getting that feedback. In any way, it's gold. Everything, every complaint, every compliment is like a nugget of gold that has something in there that's telling you how to modify whatever it is that you're bringing. Oftentimes in medicine, when you're interviewing a patient, my mentors would say, just listen to the patient. They'll tell you the diagnosis. If you just listen carefully enough, and here it's almost like listen to the product. They'll tell you what it needs to be and where to go. And I think that's really has been good advice throughout my career.
Very good. Well, Oscar, this was incredible conversation. If anyone wants to continue to nerd with you on this or just chat, where can they find you? Is that LinkedIn? Is that X? Where do you hang?
So I this is going to be surprising. I tend to hang probably on LinkedIn, if anything. That's where my stuff is. I don't hang so much on X. I got to say, I've been taking social network type of stuff out of my day-to-day activity. You can get lost for hours, as we all know, in that, and suddenly just, where did 6 hours go? So in order to avoid that, I don't spend as much time on social media. I try not to. I don't have like a Facebook account or Instagram account or anything like that, which sounds horribly incongruous to somebody who's a CIO or a CDO in technology, but you can find me on LinkedIn.
Very well. Thank you so much for this, and thank you for sharing your experience and wisdom.
Thanks, Aji.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Modern Business Operations. You can see the show notes and all of the resources mentioned in today's episode at tonkin.com/mbopod. Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe for updates on future episodes. And if you're interested in staying up to date on all things business operations, join the Tonkin community at tonkin.com/community.